prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Thursday, June 29th, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Melody. Happy National Handshake Day.
Okay. Before or after COVID?
Gotcha. You got me. After. Man, should we call it fist bump day then? Yeah. Well, believe it or not, on the last Thursday of June every year, people across the world celebrate National Handshake Day.
I wonder if they really do.
You wonder how many of us have heard it. I know I didn't before today. One of the most, ancient forms of greetings among us humans. The origin hard to pinpoint. All those theories suggest it was a way for medieval knights, Roman soldiers, and other weapon-carrying men to check for hidden dangers, daggers, by grasping each other's forearms and greetings. Even older record in Egypt suggests the handshake held a different sort of power, the power of giving. According to Babylonian custom, kings would grasp the hand of the statues of the god Marduk before taking the throne. Some places, like in the U.S., handshakes are firm. Other places, a lot of Asian countries, not so much. You don't avoid eye contact as well. Anyway, when my wife gets home from work this evening, forget about our traditional hug and kiss, Melody. She's getting a good old handshake.
There you go. All right. It's kind of interesting. And we go back a long ways, don't we? So gold today didn't go back a long ways, but hey, it's still in the green, $1,909, basically unchanged. Silver was down a little bit. At $22.65. Platinum was down 15, 906. Palladium was down 33, at 1,263. Dollar USDX, yes, that is up 103.33. There go the pressure on gold. Crude oil was up 26 cents, still below 70, 69.82. Paper markets today. A whopping day in the Dow, still under 1%, 34,122. S&P barely changed, up 19. And the NASDAQ was unchanged at 13,591. Asian markets, Nikkei was positive. Everything else was in red territory. Europe, the Dow and the FTSE was negative, but just marginal. I mean, just fractionally, just a few points. The USDX today popped 3.84%, 3.84%. And drum roll for natural gas, just under 1% at 2.693. And I guess the big news was all your major banks pop on stress test results. And we're going to talk a little bit about GDP was also revised, of course, to the upside. And we'll probably see a lot of that during the election. But interesting stress tests, all good. So, you know, why wouldn't they be good? They always get bailed out and they always get that extra money. So, I mean, it's like, what's the point of stress tests when they know they're going to get bailed out? But anyway, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the GDP. Gross domestic product increased at a 2% annualized pace for the January through March period. Now, the previous estimate was only 1.3% ahead of the 1.4% consensus that is forecast for the second quarter. Now, this is the final estimate for the first quarter GDP. The growth rate was 2.6% in the fourth quarter of 2022. So it is down from last year. The upward revision helps undercut widespread expectations that the U.S. is heading toward a recession. But folks, 2% prior to 2020, I think we were running at 3% and 4%. I do believe, maybe even higher. So I don't think 2% is something to get all warm and fuzzy about. And the thinking that there's not going to be a recession at a 2%. Consumer spending, that rose 4.2%. This is the highest quarterly pace since the second quarter of 2021. So, I don't know, it just doesn't all make sense, Dave, but we talk about that every day, how it doesn't seem like so many of these reports make sense.
Yeah, and it certainly doesn't help that there's so many mixed signals coming at us all the time, and that noise makes it all the more challenging to figure out our humble little place in this crazy, crazy economy. An 8.7% boost in the Social Security cost of living adjustment in January likely boosted the consumer numbers. That's according to Scott Hoyt at Moody's Analytics. But blame it on us seniors, Melody. Overall, however, the economy remains admirably resilient, he said, and odds of recession beginning this year are receding. But the coast is far from clear. Well, that's for sure. Now, there's also some news in the inflation front that they're considering good. Core PCE prices, personal consumption index, expenditures index, the Fed's preferred inflation metric. But the core PCE, excluding the volatile food and energy segment, rose 4.9% for the period. And that was a downward revision of a tenth of a point. Oh boy. But again, Fed policymakers keep their eye on core PCE, trying to get inflation back to their 2% target. Major focus of the Fed, of course, has been the labor market. We'll talk about that more in a minute. There currently are about 1.7 open positions for every available worker. And that tightness has resulted in a push for higher wages that generally have not kept pace with inflation.
Well, we have applications for the unemployment benefits that fell significantly last week. You know, everyone thinking claims are appearing to stabilize. First-time jobless claims fell by 26,000 to 239. This is for the week ending of June 24th. Now, this is all reported by the Labor Department. Economists were expecting the elevated claim numbers to continue above the 260, the 260,000, because that's kind of where they settled at for the past couple of weeks. But experts have no specific explanation, of course not, for the sudden dip. Why would they when it's pulled out of a hat? But anyway, after three straight weeks in a narrow trading range or a narrow range between 262 and 265. Some analysts said that the observations for individual weeks always have to be viewed with skepticism, especially when they move against the established trend in claims and other data. So 4-week moving average of claims, which evens out some of the weeks to week-to-week volatility, rose by 1,500, Dave.
Well, the economy's added 20 million jobs. I beg your pardon. It's added jobs at a furious pace since more than 20 million jobs were, well, eliminated, basically, when the pandemic hit in the spring of 2020, or lost, anyway. Americans have enjoyed unusual job security as many companies have been reluctant to shed their staff in this worker-friendly labor environment, and with the economy, more to the point, being so tenuous. Employers added a surprising 339,000 jobs last month, painting a mostly encouraging, and I'm going to call it a snapshot, of the job market. But a number of high-profile layoffs, we talk about them a lot in the tech sector, where companies overhired during the pandemic. Manufacturing sector has been contracting. Real estate sector has suffered because of high interest rates. Of course, three bank failures in March have been blamed in part on higher interest rates. Over 1.74 million people collecting unemployment for the week ending June 17th. That's about 19,000 fewer than the previous week, Melody.
Well, you know what? I just pulled up real quick. I'll have to look at this a little bit more during the break, pulling up the GDP. And it kind of looks like now the 2019, we had a big first quarter. That was over 3%. And then it mellowed out at 2% for the next three quarters. The last quarter of 2018 was like at 1%. 2017 to 2018, it was 2.5% and 3.5% throughout the year. So, overall, it looks pretty steady, just a little bit above 2%. But we did have those few good years in 2017 and 2018. But then again, remember, we were heading in 2019, the overnight funding. Billions of dollars were being pumped in there, and that's where we say that this whole true recession really truly started was in September of 2019. And it's interesting now you got these economists that are saying that a historic surge in the percentage of distressed American companies are going to worsen from the fallout for the Fed's big fight against inflation. Well, the Fed wants to fight against inflation, stop printing money. How about that? That's pretty a simple solution. But you have these two analysts, two Federal Reserve economists, Orev and Timmer, said the share of non-financial firms in financial distress has reached a level that is higher than during most previous tightening episodes since the 70s. The upshot is that the Fed's hikes to interest rates intended to curb the pace of price increases by raising borrowing costs threatened to have a magnified influence on business investment, employment, and economic activity. And why? Because that's because debt-ridden companies will likely balk at spending money on new equipment or facilities, hiring more people, and ramping up production. The percentage of troubled firms stands at about 37%. Now, this could lead to the Fed's rate hikes having some of the most devastating effects of any on its tightening cycles over the past four decades. There wasn't this much debt back then when you're looking over the past 30, 40 years. Dave. That's the difference.
Indeed. Thank you, President Nixon, you know, the gold standard.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of purchasing power lost. But what's interesting, the critical paper by the, well, these insiders, really, goes on to say that the full extent of the Fed's damage won't be felt until 18 months from now. That perspective is one of the reasons a number of people out there believe the Fed should just, you know, keep their hands off the economy right now for a little bit longer and let some of these lagging effects take place more gradually. But of course, I think the Fed is too obsessed, I mean committed, to getting inflation down, that they're just not going to be able to help themselves. I mean, 3/4 of people who participate in the CME Group's Fed Watch tool, the Fed Funds Futures trading, see another 25 base point increase at their next meeting next month. I think as we get another week or two closer to that, that's going to be closer to 100%. You know, 10 consecutive rate hikes. Well, with this last pause this month, a lot of people don't know where we're headed. I certainly don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, much less, you know, 18 months from now. But, you know, one or two more rate hikes in this already interesting environment. I think the prospects of further hikes has a lot of investors, precious metals and otherwise, worried the Fed's going overboard and just might tip the economy into a recession unnecessarily, Melody. Although I guess some CFOs might disagree with that.
Well, exactly. But you can't expect the world at record debt and not have impacts and fallout from rising rates. They can't service the debt. And so, you know, they're using up everything that they had, and they have to reload those loans and everything. So, yeah, I mean, it is a domino, and it does take time for it to filter through for most people. I mean, because we do this every day, Dave, I see, anyway, the various impacts in various markets and various companies and the things that we read and so forth. But for the general populace out there, they're not gonna know until they lose their jobs or they get impacted directly. Inflation impacts them directly, but they have a way of adjusting. And so they'll cut out their $8 coffees in the morning, you know, so they can go on a July 4th trip or something like that. So they do adjust, and they use their credit cards. They're using their credit cards because we've seen that debt increasing, and a lot of that increase in debt is to for their everyday needs, you know, for energy, for, you know, for food, for housing. So it's, I don't know why, when you have a big part of the economy being affected, that people just, it doesn't seem to have an awareness to where it should be. And I think that's all due to the stock market. I think people believe as long as that stock market is high and those numbers are rising, that they could have a fire burning down their home and everything is good. So, but you're right about the CFO still being skeptical. The big stock market rally defied expectations of a worsening economy is finding new support from what has been a skeptical contingent. While far from the unanimous in their view of the market, there are some CFOs now see the Dow Jones as being able to continue its rise, even if CFOs' view on the economy's direction remain negative. Of course they're going to say that. Why else wouldn't they? They don't want it to drop, so they're not going to feed any negative into it. But last quarter, only 13% of CFOs said that they could see a new high for the Dow, while more than half expected a return to 30,000. We can finish this up when we get back. We're heading into a break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. And I guess coming up this week, Dave, you mentioned during the break that we'll be having a blog instead of the actual newsletter come this Monday.
Yes.
Correct? Yes.
Correcto mundo.
Okay. We might still, if Wendy died, I don't know if Wendy will do an article in that or not. So I don't know if you might want to just check with her. But so you'll get something, ladies and gentlemen, to keep us in your everyday thoughts and the thoughts that you should be buying gold and silver. 1-800-375-4188. And just to finish this up, you know, again, you know, I mean, there's going to be a lot of money coming into these into the economy and so forth. And everyone thinks that the stock market's just going to continue. And over 80% of CFOs in the second quarter survey say they still expect a recession to occur. The timeline has once again moved down, with only one third of CFOs expecting a downturn to start in the second half of this year, Dave.
Yeah, but still more than a third see a recession coming, just not as soon as they had been seeing it 6 months ago. I mean, I think that's still significant because a lot of them are and have been particularly in the tech sector, making these layoff moves with that recession in mind. Now, CFOs say inflation also has peaked. A third of them continue to see inflation as their number one risk. And while consumer spending and credits remained relatively, I guess we can call it strong, resilient, 18% of CFOs rate consumer demand as the next biggest risk. Overregulation is also cited by about one in five as the number one risk. So interesting stuff. I mean, as Melody mentioned, there is a bunch of money still moving through the economy, aside from what is created by the Fed. I mean, you've got the 2021 American Rescue Plan Act, a lot of several billion dollars, multi-billions of dollars sitting in state and local government bank accounts. That money has to be spent by the end of 2025 or be returned. In addition, last year's Inflation Reduction Act and the spending from the federal infrastructure bill are beginning to fuel new projects around the U.S. thanks to good old debt. So, you know, those programs are going to increase the demand for goods and services and labor at a time when the Fed's attempting to cool them all. So, mixed signals abound, Melody.
Well, the reason the mixed signals is because they're not doing what needs to be done in order to really fix the problem. So that, I mean, you know, so nothing will ever make sense until they actually start addressing and doing what needs to be done to fix the problem. So you're going to, we're going to keep getting these mixed reports and nothing's going to make sense because it can't make sense. It's this dysfunctional system and it's not working properly. And they just do whatever need. They print more money to fix the problems instead of correcting the problem. And so, yeah, it's just going to continue. And in the meantime, you have pending home sales. They fell in May. Contracts to buy previously owned homes fell more than expected in May, dropping to the lowest level in 5 months. This is all from the National Association of Realtors. The pending home sales index based on signed contracts dropped 2.7% to 76.5 last month. This is the lowest level since December. So, and again, pending home sales tumbled 22% in May on a year-on-year basis. So, anything you'd like to add to that, Dave?
Nope. I think that that says all that needs to be said about that.
And here, I mean, this is true. I mean, I kind of said it so in the beginning. How you feel about the economy and so forth all comes down to your paycheck. If your wages are outpacing inflation, which I don't think very many are, things are fine. If not, well, you know, that's, you know, quite dispiriting. And this is a new paper from an economist, Darren Grant. I don't quite get what this, you know, maybe it's better for you to go into this, Dave, because I get conflicting. I mean, if everything, if you're making a good income and everything is outpacing inflation and everything would be well, right?
Well, it depends. this economist Grant trying to answer the question plaguing people who pay attention to this kind of stuff. Why was consumer sentiment so dismal even as the economy skyrocketed and unemployment hit record lows? Well, so they say, the government. And this article suggests that his findings have big potential impacts politically as the president tries to sell Americans on the success of, quote, Bidenomics. The contradictions between how Americans feel about the economy and the actual state of it certainly is going to play a key role in the 2024 presidential election. Always has in modern times, always will.
True.
Yesterday, Biden talked up his economic record to folks in Chicago, talking about job growth, low unemployment rates, especially for women and blacks, and his infrastructure legislation. Touted record wage growth for low-wage workers, too. The thing is, the overall picture for wage growth is a less positive story. I mean, until very recently, real wage growth, that is, inflation-adjusted wage growth, was negative for Americans on average. And now that it's inflation is beginning to back off a tad, real wage growth has begun turning positive. Consumer sentiment is picking up, too. The question is, will it last? Grant, who teaches at Sam Houston State University in Texas, says, well, the deal isn't really sealed with the American people until real wages start to grow. Now, his paper finds Americans viewing the economy deeply connected to the unemployment rate. When the jobless rate's low, people's moods are brighter. When he updated his research last year, he found that was no longer the case, but he didn't understand why. He wasn't alone. Economists and journalists puzzled over this, attributed the shift to partisanship, media coverage, the pandemic, inflation. Well, Grant spent the last year looking at wage growth data from the Atlanta Fed to see how it correlated with his data on sentiment. Turns out strong connections remain, particularly among workers in their 30s and 40s, the prime working ages who are most strongly attached to the workforce. Bottom line, Melody, still the case when people's incomes are going up, they feel better about their economy.
Well, I think it's wonderful that people's economies are going up. People's economies. Well, they have their own personal economies, but their incomes are going up. But are they really? I mean, when you look at inflation, I mean, the numbers that they give us, I mean, look how inflation is determined. So, you know, it's the same way with the unemployment. You don't get the real numbers. So what has gone down in inflation? Gasoline has come down a little bit. It's beginning to move back up. It should come down a little bit more or at least stabilize.
Hey, eggs are down. I bought eggs for the first time yesterday.
They're down, but they're still high.
They're much higher than they were in 2019. Yeah.
So, you know, it's just such, again, we're looking at this distorted numbers and reports and so forth, that when the average guy out there doesn't have more than, you know, a $500 or $1,000 emergency backup, that's pretty pathetic. So, and how can their debt continue to be rising? You know, so again, things just don't make sense. And that's the world we live in. UPS looks like that the largest single employer strike now appears inevitable. These are by Sean O'Brien, Teamsters General President. A standoff between UPS and the Teamsters over their new contract is intensifying. Yesterday, O'Brien said a strike would happen if the company didn't improve its offer on wages and benefits. The union said UPS had until Friday to come back to the table with something better or risk a strike, and they're looking at August 1st. So they're not going to strike. They'll come up with something.
I think they will too.
Yeah, it ain't going to happen.
I think if it gets closer to the deadline, we'll see another announcement from the White House or someone on either side, either with the union or with the company, is going to suggest the White House get involved in trying to make sure a strike doesn't happen. I mean, the economy is a lot more dependent on the delivery of packages than we were just 4 years ago. If UPS's 340,000 workers went out on strike, saying their competitors, FedEx, U.S. Postal Service, wouldn't be able to absorb the 20 million packages that UPS delivers every day. The strike would definitely hurt. It would hurt their own workers, hurt the company shareholders, and gonna hurt a lot of customers, particularly in the U.S., but also around the world. Again, the workers are looking for more money, a bigger piece of the UPS profits now that the company finances are doing so well. UPS says in a statement, "We remain at the table, ready to negotiate." So I like you, Melody, do believe there will be
a resolution. And the thing it is, when they strike, who's actually – is the whole company going to be striking, or are they still going to be running, you know, shifts and still delivering, you know. It's just not – they're just not going to shut down. So, you know, it's – they'll – so I'm not sure how big of an impact. It would probably be people who buy shirts on Amazon or, you know, something like that, those packages don't get delivered. They're no big deals, but, you know, so the important things would still be delivered, I would think. Mm-hmm. But, they ain't going to just shut the company down. I can't imagine. Maybe. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that would be scheduled. So, let's go ahead and move on to, since we're going to kind of run out of time, toward the end of 2010, there was a widening bipartisan sense in Washington anyway that fiscal deficits don't matter, but now all of a sudden they do again. The federal government's budget deficit is now at levels that have surpassed only in deep crises and are forecast to widen from here. And if unchecked, you get the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is warning that would imply higher interest rates and inflation and less private investment and growth in the coming decades. The government is set to run a deficit of 5.8% of GDP this fiscal year. The CBO said a period in which the headline unemployment rate has averaged 3.6% so far. Now, the deficit exceeded that level in only 7 years since 1962, all of which coincided with rebounds in 1983, in the aftermath of a severe recession, 2009 to 2012. Now, this was after the Great Recession, and 2021 during the COVID pandemic. The deficit is on track to narrow as a share of the economy later this decade before soaring in the 2030s and 2040s. So these numbers, however, assume relatively steady economic growth and not the kind of surprise shocks like major recessions, wars, or financial crises that have a way of upending fiscal forecasts for the worst. Yeah, and I've no doubt that we'll be in a war pretty soon. In the late 2010s, interest rates seemed locked at perpetually low levels, leading to widespread. So there you have it, Dave.
Well, back in 2017, net interest costs for the U.S. government were only 1.4% of GDP. In 2023, with a higher debt load and higher interest rates, that's on track to be almost double at 2.5%. Now, 1.1 percentage points higher doesn't seem to be a lot. It's a heck of a lot in dollar terms. Net interest reaches an astounding 6.7% of GDP by the early 2050s under CBO projections. And that's given current policies, Melody. That doesn't include any new budget deals that are just going to make it even worse. So it's time to start paying attention, as we talk about all the time on this program.
Well, I think it should be our number one. It is, to me, it is our number one problem. But anyway, we'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. Come on, baby.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Melody's taking care of other clients this final segment, so you'll have me, Dave Allen, all to yourself. You know where to reach Melody, 1-800-375-4188. Hey, if you believe the results of the Fed's annual stress tests, too big to fail, U.S. banks have more than enough capital, or most of them anyway. As a result, five of the six largest U.S. banks, apart from Citigroup, are likely to see their capital requirements lowered for the year ahead after sailing through a tougher test than last year with smaller losses. Now, investors, though, are unlikely to get an explosion of dividends or buybacks, as the same banks are about to be hit with these demands for more capital. In the next few weeks, the Fed will say how it plans to apply the final version of these new global capital rules. The proposal has been out there for years. Remarkably, the industry has little idea about what the outcome is going to be. The bank execs are fairly certain that capital requirements are about to go up, But by how much and in what form remain a mystery, given that the latest stress tests show that banks are strong, in their own words. Why bolster capital requirements through other rule changes? The main aim is to make banks more comparable, at least internationally, but regulators also seem to be addressing the long-held suspicions that banks' internal risk models are too clever for their own good and let them game the system. I mean, hear, hear. In the U.S., Bloomberg's Paul Davey says a simplified view of risk set by regulators is starting to replace the real detailed models created by the mega banks. The main reason he says banks are in the dark about the outcome, is that the politics, personnel, and market conditions have changed dramatically since regulators began the work. It started under Randall Quarles, the former Fed supervision chief, vice chair, who was part of a Trump administration that was more friendly toward banking interests. It finishes under Michael Barr, appointed by a more finance-phobic Biden White House, particularly after the string of bank failures in March. Executives went from expecting little change in industry-wide capital requirements to thinking an increase of 5 to even 10% was possible. Now they're worrying it might even be more than 10%. Media reports have pegged the rise at more than 20, in fact. But that probably comes from adding up the worst version of the expected proposals and not allowing for any potential mitigation. There are lots of moving parts, so tougher rules in one area could be offset by easier treatment in another. The changes are likely to increase the size of bank balance sheets by adjusting just how risk is measured. But this growth should be partly countered by lowering the ratio of capital to assets that banks have to meet. And in my mind, that's where the rubber hits the road. I mean, the Fed's headline proposal may start out high, but get managed down through technical tweaks during discussions over the coming year. So what's actually changing? Well, it's complicated. I mean, banks work out how much capital they need by measuring the size of their balance sheets based on the riskiness of each asset. For example, a $100 loan to an investment-grade blue chip company gets recorded as smaller than a $100 loan to a highly indebted junk-rated borrower. This also applies to trading positions and judging the chances of default by counterparties in derivative trades. More on that in a second. One big change from the Fed will be in sizing trading desk exposures. Sophisticated banks, which is to say the real big ones, currently use value at risk, which benefits from the tendency of some markets to move in opposite directions from one another. The new standard measures each risk separately, removing this diversification benefit. I mean, for the big five, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, this could increase their total risk-weighted assets by between 2 and 8%, according to some analysts. Another big change adds estimates for the losses that banks can suffer from failures in, like, information technology systems, human errors, or, you know, even misconduct, collectively known as operational risk. Estimates of the effect of adding this vary wildly. You have analysts from Bank of America say it will increase JP Morgan's risk, for example, their risk-weighted assets by 17%, where Morgan Stanley analysts expect the impact for the same bank could be barely half that. Whatever the case, I mean, the big banks already assess operational risks in their internal models under what's known as the advanced approach to calculating risk-weighted assets. The Fed will add a simpler version to these risk weightings under its standardized approach, which the smaller banks in particular rely on. But here's the rub for bigger banks. They also have to report their balance sheets using the standardized approach, a calculation that in reality has become more restrictive for them over time as regulators have beefed it up. So for almost all of the six biggest U.S. banks, risk-weighted assets measured by the standardized approach are now greater than under their own internal models. That means they report lower capital ratios under the former than the latter, so the regulators view as more influence over whether they can make payouts to investors, dividends, or buybacks. Some analysts say these latest changes will make big banks' internal modeling permanently irrelevant. That wouldn't be such a bad thing. The multi-billion dollar question is, how do all these changes translate into capital requirements, which are a percentage of risk-weighted assets? All banks have to meet a 4.5% minimum plus a so-called stress capital buffer that comes out of these stress tests, which adds at least another 2.5%. Goldman Sachs had the largest stress buffer last year at 6.3. Wednesday's results suggest most big banks will see this buffer cut and start reporting their new numbers from Friday. Lastly, the biggest lenders face further demands because they're deemed as globally systemically important banks, G-SIB for short. J.P. Morgan's G-SIB buffer is the largest at 4% of risk-weighted assets, rising to 4.5% next year. And banks hate this. J.P. Morgan execs regularly call it conceptually flawed. Whatever. It's based on size and several other considerations, but given all the other rule changes are going to increase the apparent size and capital requirements of the big banks anyway, they might finally have an argument for getting the G-SIB buffer cut. Well, the Fed's proposal on all these changes should land by the middle of July. Capital requirements will be going up, but probably not by as much as feared. Too big to fail banks continue to be a source of potential financial system instability. But the real-world stress test of the past few years, they'd like us to believe, have shown them to be more robust. But how in God's name these mega banks with literally dozens and dozens of trillions of dollars of liability from their investments in highly risky derivative products can be considered robust is apparently beyond my pay grade. What it all means, the politics and technical complexity for investors, well, we won't get a clear view of for at least a few more months. Stick around, ladies and gentlemen. Excuse me. Well, let's end today's program by addressing the elephant in the room. Earlier today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that the affirmative action admission policies of Harvard and the University of North Carolina are unconstitutional. The ruling's a huge blow to four decades of efforts to boost enrollment of racial minorities at American colleges and universities through policies that enabled them to take into account an applicant's race. Chief Justice John Roberts, in the majority opinion, which included all five of his fellow conservative justices, said eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it. Roberts' opinion said that both Harvard's and UNC's affirmative action programs unavoidably employ race in a negative manner, involving racial stereotyping and lack meaningful endpoints. He added, "We have never permitted admission programs to work that way, and we will not do so today," finding that the school's policies violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution's 14th Amendment, which, of course, bars states from denying people equal protection under the law. Chief Justice added that nothing prohibits universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected the applicant's life, so long as that discussion is concretely tied to a quality of character or unique ability that the particular applicant can contribute to the university, which calls into question how in God's name is this going to be enforced. Justice Clarence Thomas, a black justice who wrote the concurring opinion, said that the school's affirmative action policies fly in the face of our colorblind constitution. Two discriminatory wrongs cannot make a right. Excuse me. In her dissent to the majority, newest Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's also black, called the ruling truly a tragedy for us all. Her fellow Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, today this court stands in the way and rolls back decades of precedent and momentous progress. Sotomayor, calling the ruling profoundly wrong and devastating, said that the majority holds that race can no longer be used in a limited way in college admissions to achieve such critical. In doing so, she argued the Supreme Court cements a superficial rule of colorblindness as a constitutional principle in an endemically segregated society where race has always mattered and continues to do so. Now, Harvard said in a lengthy statement, we will certainly comply with the court's decision. But in the weeks and months ahead, drawing on the talent and expertise of our Harvard community, we will determine how to preserve, consistent with the court's new precedent, our essential values. UNC Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz said, Carolina remains firmly committed to bringing together talented students with different perspectives and life experiences and continues to make an affordable, high-quality education accessible to the people of North Carolina and beyond. While not the outcome we had hoped for, we will carefully review the Supreme Court's decision and take any steps necessary to comply with the law. Now, in a footnote to the majority opinion, Roberts indicated that the decision does inexplicably not apply to the U.S. military academies. He wrote this, no military academy is a party to these cases, and none of the courts below addressed the propriety of race-based admissions in that context. So it's apparently okay to train racial minorities to prepare for war and kill and be killed, but not to further their education? That's an interesting paradox. Someone explain that to me, please. NAACP CEO Derek Johnson blasted the ruling, saying in a statement today, the Supreme Court is bound to the personally held beliefs of an extremist minority. The tricks of America's dark past will not be tolerated. Let me be clear, he continued. Affirmative action exists because we cannot rely on colleges, universities, and employers to enact admissions and hiring practices that embrace diversity, equity, and inclusion. Yet race plays an undeniable role in shaping the identities and quality of life for Americans who happen to be Black. Well, let me know how you feel about this, the decision, the issue in general. Email me at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. That's daveallen, A-L-L-E-N, .usa@yahoo.com. I'll read your comments on a future program. Hey! That's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Thursday after the July 4th holiday. No program on Tuesday. Melody will be back tomorrow with Butch to close out this week. I'm so sorry. Also be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes in the morning, along with a special edition on Monday. Thanks always to our production engineer, Todd Waite. And to you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a great holiday weekend and a good evening. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.